I next met with Dr. Gary Lyman from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. And to begin, I asked him to provide the background and rationale for the development of biosimilars.
The primary driver of the new biosimilars that are being introduced into oncology practice is the cost of healthcare, and specifically the cost of cancer care. And a big part of that are the drug prices. Much of the rapid rise in cancer drug prices over the last decade or so have been these exciting new biologic therapies, as you know, across disease types. And these, of course, range from both curative adjuvant therapies through metastatic patients. Really exciting results, not without their side effects, but the real issue has been the financial impact of these. The prices of these have gone up. They've skyrocketed. The average price at the time of FDA approval of biologics over the last few years has been over $10,000 a month for a typical course of therapy. So that's been the big driver. It's now correlating with the fact that the patents on a number of these agents is expiring. And no big surprise, there are companies out there that have been anxious to get into the marketplace with similar types of agents. It's complicated, though, because we're not talking about small molecules and developing generics, which can be synthesized precisely in the laboratory and replicated identically, and you can have very high level of confidence that they're the same. These are biologic agents. They're large molecules by and large. They're complicated, generally proteins. They are produced in living systems, cells, and they cannot be replicated exactly because of the complexity of their development, manufacturing, processing, and so forth. So the real challenge is, how can we identify these agents when they are sufficiently similar, and the FDA calls it highly similar, in terms of their safety and efficacy to the original biologic reference product. And so obviously, if we require the same level of evidence that we've traditionally required for new cancer agents, including biologic therapies, generally large phase 3 randomized comparative trials, if we require that same level of evidence for these biosimilars, we won't meet our primary objective here, which is to provide competition and bring down drug costs for managing cancer patients and hopefully improving access to these agents in patients and populations where access is limited because of the cost issue. So we've tried to find, and the FDA struggled to find, a balance between enough evidence to provide reassurance that these drugs are highly similar, they're safe and efficacious for the indications that the original reference product was approved for, but not so much evidence that the cost of development and marketing will, if anything, drive prices up further and certainly not rein in prices. So, you know, in the last few years, the FDA has developed regulations. They have now approved biosimilars based largely on demonstrating analytic chemical similarity, the same amino acid sequence as the reference product. They have to be highly similar in terms of their PK and PD criteria. Animal studies are done. But when it comes to the clinical comparative studies, far more limited evidence is required. So we have what we call a reverse pyramid compared to the original reference biologic. Much more emphasis on the analytic and mechanisms of action, the animal preclinical work, and then some clinical work, particularly pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic, immunogenicity testing, make sure there's no unexpected immunogenicity issues, and then some limited comparative data, but it doesn't have to be large phase 3 trials. So the first agent's out.
Could I just interrupt you for a second before we go on? Because I'd like to then, you know, with that beginning, start to get into more depth about various specific agents and what kind of research was done. But just maybe to take a step back a little bit, you mentioned the issue of cost. From a macro point of view, what fraction of the cost of cancer care is drugs to start with? And of that, what fraction is biologics?
Yeah, well, these are moving targets. So the best estimates that I've seen is that about a quarter to a third of the cost of cancer care are probably directly related to the drugs, to the treatments. Of course, we have other drivers like imaging tests. We know how expensive those are. Hospitalizations, particularly when side effects, toxicities require hospitalization or emergency room visits. So it's not the only thing. It's a piece of the puzzle, but it's one that hopefully, combined with other efforts, we can begin to constrain the rise that we've seen, which has just been exponential over the last 5 to 10 years in the U.S.
And again, if you just even a rough estimate of when you look at the costs for drugs for cancer patients, you know, roughly what fraction of that do you think is biologics?
Right now, it's about 20 to 30%. But it's increasing, and it's going up progressively. It's estimated that globally, biologics are about $250 billion market at this point. And in the U.S., of course, we're just starting the biosimilars. It's yet to be shown that the introduction of these agents will really drive down drug prices. We do have the advantage that in Europe, the European Union, and of course, they have a slightly different review and approval process through the EMA, but there's a lot of coordination and back and forth. So the FDA has learned a great deal from about a decade of experience with these agents in the EU. And what they have seen is as these biosimilars get introduced in the European markets, they've driven down prices of the biologic sphere about 20 to 30%. Now, it's not an 80% price drop like we've seen with some generics. And these are still complicated molecules and difficult to produce. But there is evidence from the EU experience that it can begin to bring down prices, particularly when there's multiple biosimilars in the same class of agents. So just one may not do a whole lot, but two or three compared to the reference biologic may begin to drive down prices. Just as importantly, though, with that decade of experience, no biosimilar introduced in Europe with pretty similar types of regulatory processes has had to be withdrawn or has been taken off the market because of safety and efficacy concerns. So that, you know, that doesn't mean we won't have something in the future, but that's pretty reassuring with well over 24 biosimilars in the European space, including over 12 oncologic biosimilars, and now some of them out over 10 years. So we've learned a lot from that. So although we're getting a late start, I think that's going to be reassuring to oncologists in the U.S. that there is a track record here that looks very reassuring.
Any other experience internationally with biosimilars outside of the EU?
It's primarily the EU. Now, of course, these agents are available in places like India and Southeast Asia, even in South America, but the regulatory controls are very different. Plus, the tracking of the experience in terms of adverse events and the financial numbers are just far more limited. And I think most would understand that the practice of oncology in Europe is probably closer to that of the U.S. than just about any place else globally.
When you look at the potential advantages of biosimilars, is it pretty much cost or any other potential advantages?
Well, of course, it is primarily cost, but that has ripple effects. As I mentioned, drug access and the financial impact on patients. If a biologic is the appropriate treatment for their care and they have options and their insurers or payers or their health system have options to utilize less expensive versions of this, it may improve access. We know that financial toxicity is a huge issue in cancer care in the U.S. It deters some patients even going through treatment or for stopping treatment early or simply not getting the optimal type of treatment. And I think that's the hope here. It's not just the price, although we're all concerned about the cost of healthcare, but it's quality of care, access to care. And this led, you may have seen the President's Cancer Panel recently issued a report to the White House about the cost of healthcare in general, pretty much focused on oncology and strongly encouraging the White House and the federal government to do whatever they can to encourage the development of biosimilars as a mechanism, not the only one, to rein in the cost of cancer care.
You know, it's interesting, as a purveyor of continuing medical education, I'm always trying to figure out to what extent is our audience going to find a topic interesting. And when you look into the biosimilar story, it's really fascinating in terms of how you look at the data. We're going to get into it in a second. But it kind of, I have the feeling that maybe right now at this particular instant, I'm not sure how strong of motivation there is in both oncologists and even patients to decrease the cost. Often, it's not going to really be reflected on the patient. Sometimes, yes, or copays, et cetera. But, you know, without any other real motivation to use a biosimilar, kind of, I don't know how strong at an individual level a doc or even a patient might be to try to decrease costs, because, you know, if you get down to it, you'll never be able to 100% reassure either the doc or patient that they're going to see the same thing without a phase 3 study. But the thing that I've been thinking about is that the day could come very, very quickly when that the whole construct maybe would change. And either patients or physicians, maybe with a different structuring of how payment is made, how value is determined, I'm not even sure, that could change maybe quickly. And at that point, these issues might become much more pragmatic. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. There's enormous uncertainty about where we're going to be in terms of payment models and pay-for-performance measures. You know, different organizations, ASCOs and others, have proposed different approaches, but we absolutely don't know. It's so politicized. And I agree with you completely. It's unknown how much cost or price as a driver will change practice, particularly in the U.S., which is, at least my experience having lived in Europe as well as most of my life in the U.S., a far more independent and self-driving type of philosophy of medical care in the U.S. Physicians want to be able to do what's best for their patients and not be told what to do. And so they're going to both need evidence that these drugs are safe and effective and they're not compromising the patient's care. But hopefully on top of that, we'll begin to see some impact on healthcare delivery costs and so forth. But I think it's really the safety and efficacy issue, which is paramount. As I talk with colleagues around the country, there's skepticism about these agents. They've pretty much accepted generics, sometimes kicking and screaming, but they've come on board with most of those, a lot of it being kind of pushed down their throats, so to speak. But I think most of our experiences have been pretty good there. This is a whole different playing field. And again, the objective here is to require less of the very costly large phase 3 trials and putting all the emphasis on the preclinical and more pharmacologic demonstration that these are highly similar to the original. It doesn't stop there, though, Neil. The FDA policy criteria for biosimilars also has a criteria of extrapolation. And as you know, many drugs, particularly biologics, seek and get label approval for several different indications, either in different disease settings or different stage. And they do that by providing evidence from clinical trials, again, that it's safe and effective for that indication. Even some of the growth factors and supportive care agents have multiple indications that they've been given based on clinical trial data that they provided. Now the biosimilars come into our arena and the FDA says, well, you need to demonstrate efficacy and safety for a primary indication, but if you do that and we don't see any big issues in terms of immunogenicity, any red flags, we have the right to grant approval for the biosimilar for other indications that the reference biologic is approved for, but without needing to see any additional data. So they don't require any clinical data for these. They reserve the right not to grant extrapolation, but so far they've been doing that for the supportive care biosimilars that have come along. That's a foreign concept for all of us to have an extrapolated indication for which there's been no clinical evidence provided of safety and efficacy. Again, that's worked in Europe. And again, no red flags have come up. But I think there's a lot of skepticism in the U.S. There's all sorts of other issues coming down the pike we can talk about, like interchangeability and substitution and so forth. None are approved for those added level of approval yet, but you could see that coming as a marketing advantage if a company comes in and gets granted interchangeability. So there's a lot of foreign concepts here. On top of it, the labeling and naming of these agents, very unusual, you know, a random four-letter added nomenclature to the original name of the product, and it doesn't have any meaning to us. And you got to learn these if you want to prescribe a particular biosimilar. I understand these are important for tracking, and a big part of this whole effort, which is post-marketing surveillance. When these are approved with much less supporting clinical evidence, I think we need to be very diligent, even after it enters the market, to be looking for rare or delayed toxicities that were not seen in the limited clinical trial data provided at the time of approval, any sign of immunogenicity. So tracking the use of these agents and the side effects of these agents in the post-marketing surveillance period will be at least as important, probably more important than we've seen for the more reference products, more traditional therapies.
I've been really trying to give this some thought, reading a lot of your work and other people's work, trying to think about it. One of the themes I think in my mind that's coming through is the issue of uncertainty. You know, how much uncertainty can you live with? If on the one hand you view the cost reduction to whatever extent that might be as a benefit, and maybe in the future it might be viewed in more beneficial, but if it is some type of benefit. And then the question is, if you don't have the exact same data in the exact same situation, can you live with it? I know in a weird way, and I know another one of your great interests is breast cancer, kind of reminds me a little bit about Oncotype and the whole idea that, you know, can you live with a little bit of uncertainty that maybe there's an advantage to giving chemotherapy to a patient with one positive node and a low Oncotype, but, you know, what's the odds? What are the complications? And this kind of has a similar flair to it. And that's really one of the things I really want to dissect out from you, which is how great is the uncertainty? Because I want to go through the process of how this is actually done. And I want to start out with the issue of, you mentioned the fact that I guess there are three levels of evidence that you can look at. One is sort of physical or physiologic, or, you know, actually looking at the compound. I think the other was animal data and the other is clinical data. Can you talk a little bit? You mentioned the fact that these are made by living cells. Maybe using the example of filgrastim, for example, and maybe trastuzumab as another example, a monoclonal antibody. How exactly are these products made? And what is the process of trying to verify that another product is similar enough to, say, trastuzumab or filgrastim?
So the processes are slightly different, but very similar between these. Although, as we mentioned, the level of concern probably goes up when you're talking about a cancer treatment as opposed to a supportive care treatment. So, and we're just getting into that level of integration of biosimilars. So in both cases, of course, again, genetic engineering takes place. You identify the gene, you clone the gene, and you introduce it into a living system, usually bacterial or yeast, which produces large quantities of these human protein molecules that have a particular function. You know, there's a whole production process of purification, isolation of these proteins. There is this issue that's somewhat related to this, and it's, again, the issue of uncertainty, is that for any biologic, we have learned over time there can be a drift, there can be changes in the molecule, either due to minor changes in manufacturing, changes in the inert ingredients that are used, a new manufacturing plant. And again, this is true of both the original reference biologic and the biosimilars, but it really is highlighted with the biosimilars because you're creating a biosimilar to an agent as it exists today, but it might be somewhat different than the reference product was at the time it was approved a decade ago. And again, the requirement of the FDA that is put on the manufacturer is whenever there is a change in production or content, the materials used in the production of these molecules, that they go through a series of tests. And again, how deep this goes depends on how major the change is. If they open a new plant, they may have to go through a whole series of testing that, again, it's the same basic protein structure, the amino acid sequence. But we know that the bonds of secondary and tertiary structure of these complex molecules are fairly weak, hydrogen bonds, and there can be slight variation, and that can affect the active site of these molecules. So there has to be some evidence, in addition to demonstrating in animal studies that there's no antibody production, and then perhaps some additional pharmacokinetic data in humans. If there have been really major changes in the manufacturing process, the FDA will come in and require certain redoing of these tests to assure that there's been no real change in the safety and efficacy of these molecules. So, I mean, it is somewhat reassuring if, you know, assuming the FDA is doing their job and the manufacturers aren't hiding anything, that there's a continuous monitoring of these, even with this propensity for drift over time, that the active component of this molecule and its mechanism of action has not changed. So again, this can extend to just the packaging of these, which can vary. So there's a list, if you go to the FDA website, of about 30 different manufacturing and production tests that they put these through, both beginning, but have the option of repeating over time. To me, that's reassuring that there's constant vigilance over these. But I think what bothers me the most, and this maybe goes to the next level of the uncertainty issue you raise, is it's extremely important that clinicians see the data that the FDA sees at the time of approval of these biosimilars. We're used to having advisory committee meetings. You know, I and many of my colleagues have served on the Oncology Drug Advisory Committee, ODAC, and the data gets presented. There's a review by the FDA. There's a review by experts. And all this is in the public domain. It's put on the website. Anybody can go there and look at the data. And that was true of the first few biosimilars that were produced. But a point that's come out, because one of the recent biosimilars approved was approved without an Oncology Drug Advisory Committee meeting and without any of the clinical evidence being published in the peer-reviewed literature. So the FDA saw the data, they were satisfied, and they approved the agent, and it's now FDA approved.
What agent is that?
So that's the biosimilar pegfilgrastim. The problem is, anecdotally, because the trial data is not in the public domain and it's not been published in peer-reviewed literature, when we looked at this at the guideline level, we said, we don't have the data. How can we make a recommendation and integrate this into clinical practice guidelines if we don't see the evidence? Yeah, we know the FDA hopefully did their due diligence. So the point I'm making is FDA approval is necessary but not sufficient for clinical integration and acceptance, and certainly for integration into clinical practice guidelines. It's essential that either the FDA be very transparent and make sure any of this data that they see when they approve these agents is put into the public space, or that the company hopefully publish the results of their trials at the earliest possible opportunity. Otherwise, they're going to see very slow uptake to their agents because we are naturally skeptics and we want to see the evidence that these really have been shown to be effective and safe.
So could you also clarify what the difference is between, I think it's a biosimilar and a interchangeable, there are two like levels there. Can you explain that?
So the FDA a year ago finalized their guidelines for interchangeability. First and foremost, no biosimilar in the U.S. has yet, and there's not a similar process in Europe, so we don't have that to look at. But there are no biosimilars yet approved in the U.S. that also have interchangeable designation. But there is a guidance for doing that. And the principle is that if you provide additional clinical evidence, and they've actually outlined the design of trials to demonstrate interchangeability that show that switching from a reference biologic to a biosimilar or an alternating back and forth between them results in no change, evident change in safety and efficacy and immunogenicity, then you may be granted this higher level of approval. It has to be approved as a biosimilar, step one, but then you have to provide this additional switching or alternating data in patients to achieve this higher level. Now, that's an added cost to a company that wants to seek this approval. It's yet to be seen, you know, if companies will see a business model or a strategic advantage to doing that. But you can imagine, as you know well, when I was treating patients in upstate New York in the wintertime, half of them went to Florida. And if they started their treatment in New York, they go to Florida. They're going to get cared for by an oncologist or in a health system there that may use nowadays a completely different biologic or biosimilar. And so potentially this could be an advantage if a biosimilar has demonstrated it's an interchangeable product and can be used in that fashion. The other aspect of this, however, which also concerns clinicians in the regulations, in the guidance, is this idea of automatic substitution. And so the guidance as it reads right now says if a biosimilar achieves interchangeable biosimilar designation, then a pharmacist gets a prescription, can substitute a reference biologic with a biosimilar that's interchangeable and not notify the clinician, not notify the oncologist or the patient. So it would be an automatic thing. Now, to get in front of this, of course, many states have developed state substitution rules. I think now close to 40 states have put restrictions on the ability of pharmacists to do automatic substitution without notification. Now, most of them are saying you can substitute, but you've got to let the prescriber know what you've done so that if there, again, any safety efficacy issues come up, they know what the patient is taking. And I think that's a reasonable stance. All this is hypothetical right now, but it does explain or illustrate how concerned we all are that we not be working blindly, that because these are approved by a different mechanism with less clinical data, we need every ounce of protection on patients. And that starts with transparency and knowing what the patient's being given when we prescribe a biologic.
What about the payers? Have there been situations or do you anticipate situations where they will only pay for a biosimilar?
I've not seen that play out yet in the Northwest. I can't say that it hasn't happened. It certainly has happened with generics, as you know, that some payers have encouraged the use of generics by saying you'll have no copay or a very small copay if you take the generic and you have to pay the full price if you want the original chemical compound. I think that's going to happen in the biosimilar space, but I have not. I think we're just too early right now. But believe me, the payers are looking at this issue. And of course, we all have the negotiated prices, and the health systems have a say in all this with their preferred agents based on contracts. But I think that's coming down the road, that there will be efforts to drive the use of biosimilars if they come in at a lower price tag than the reference biologic. And hopefully, again, there'll be competition to rein in the total price on these drugs.
So can you go through the agents right now that currently are available as biosimilars in terms of oncology and specifically talk about the data sets that supported that and also what their current costs are?
Well, the cost may be a challenge because it's a moving target. But as I mentioned, biosimilars in the U.S., and in Europe, started off with supportive care agents, and particularly one of the most costly of these, which is G-CSF. So when filgrastim came off patent, and now pegfilgrastim off patent, several companies have rushed to develop biosimilar versions of these. As you know, actually, an agent that's a biosimilar in Europe, tebofilgrastim, which went through a reference product or originator process in the U.S. because the FDA in the U.S. had not yet promulgated regulations on biosimilar approval. So they wanted to be the first out of the gate, and they went through and got approval for tebofilgrastim as an originator. What maybe will come back to haunt them, and maybe already has, is they got approval for reducing the risk of febrile neutropenia, which is, you know, the main reason these agents get used. but there was no extrapolation to other indications. So tebofilgrastim is approved for one and only one indication unless they come back with more clinical data. But they were the first out there, but technically in the U.S. they're not a biosimilar. On the other hand, filgrastim SNDZ was approved as a biosimilar, the first one out of the gate, and they got extrapolation to essentially all the extrapolated indications that the filgrastim has gotten over the years. So that's a much broader indication. And I don't have numbers, but clearly both TBO and the filgrastim SNDZ have made major inroads into the supportive care marketplace in the U.S. Their major limitation at the moment, this is my personal take on it, is their short-acting agents. So, of course, pegfilgrastim, which has been available for a decade, has a great deal of preference to patients because it's a single injection with each cycle of therapy. So again, just recently, just over the summer, actually since our article in the New England Journal on biosimilars came out in late spring, at that time, pegfilgrastim was not approved, but it has now been approved. But as I mentioned to you, concerns have been raised because the evidence available to the FDA, they did not require an oncology drug advisory committee. So that evidence was not put out in the public space. And the results of the trial data, which I've not seen, is not in the peer-reviewed literature. I think that's going to change. But that led to some consternation on the part of guideline panels saying, you know, we can't really recommend this. They have recommended both TBO and filgrastim SNDZ as equal growth factor options for cancer patients. Specifically, NCCN has integrated the biosimilar supportive care agents up to that point. But we'll see with time whether the real elephant in the room, which is pegfilgrastim biosimilar, it will get integrated in a similar fashion. I presume it will once the evidence is there for the panels to review. But because pegfilgrastim has, before the biosimilars, has garnered a great deal of the supportive care space in oncology because of the convenience and favorability of the patients.
Could you go through the clinical data that's out there right now for these biosimilars that we have? You mentioned that we don't really know what it is for PEG, but what about filgrastim? Can you talk about specifically what was done?
So what was done to get approval was an equivalence trial comparing filgrastim to the biosimilar, filgrastim SNDZ, for a reduction, looking at duration of severe neutropenia and also for the occurrence of febrile neutropenia. And it met its equivalence. It was within its equivalence margins. And that was accepted by the FDA to say, plus they, you know, all the preclinical stuff in healthy subjects, they did PK/PD studies and looked for any evidence of neutralizing antibodies and allergic reactions and so forth. You know, because these are all proteins, you do expect to occasionally see antibodies formed. But what they demonstrated was a very low level of antibody formation. It was no difference between the arms of the trial or in the healthy patient studies between those that got the originator and those that got the biosimilar. So that's what the FDA is really seeking. They're not looking for superiority studies. They're looking for equivalence and being within boundary margins that are established that assures them within, I forget, a 10 or 15% margin, that the primary outcome, which in this case, again, was severe neutropenia, was no different between the two agents. And that satisfied them along with the other safety criteria.
And it's, you know, a lot easier to sort of accept something when you can see the action in front of you. You know, you can see the white count. But so many times biosimilars, it's kind of hard to really figure out what benefit. You know, you add it on to chemotherapy, for example, bevacizumab, and you know, you don't really see in the individual patient the way you do with growth factors. I want to ask you about other approved biosimilars, but also about the biosimilar for rituximab that wasn't approved. I was kind of curious what was going on there.
Yeah, well, certainly it was not on the Oncology Drug Review Committee. I've heard and listened to some of the discussion. I think the concerns, if my recollection was right, was going back to some differences in the molecular characterization and comparability of these. So it's kind of going back to that base of the pyramid of approval. The FDA was not totally satisfied that the biosimilar product was sufficiently highly similar. You know, it is a qualitative judgment at some level. And so whether they rightfully or wrongfully disapproved that, but, you know, basically they sent the company back to redo some of their production and try again. And obviously there are other rituximabs in the pipeline. You know, there's kind of summarized in our ASCO piece and in the New England Journal article this summer. But for each of these classes of agents, there are several companies trying to do this. And it all begins with pre-ODAC discussions, and these often extend over a year or two, with the agency to make sure that the data and trial design that they're planning to do meets their perception of the evidence that will be required. But the ultimate test comes when they present the results to the FDA. And again, the FDA has to be satisfied that potency, purity, and efficacy and safety are sufficiently equivalent to the reference product, or they'll send you back to try again.
I mean, I know I'm kind of naive about trying to look at this. And of course, rheumatoid arthritis is another issue with rituximab, but it looks like there's some pretty, I mean, there's a phase three trial in follicular lymphoma that, you know, to my eyes, looks pretty impressive. There's data in rheumatoid arthritis. So the issue wasn't the clinical data, it was more the physical data?
That's my understanding. And I agree with you. If you look at beyond oncology, particularly in the rheumatology space, there was pretty convincing data, and that was provided to the FDA, of course, and was part of their review. You know, I'm presuming they weren't ready to extrapolate from a non-cancer efficacy setting, maybe a slightly different mechanism of action, to what it would be used for in the lymphoma space. It's a little hard to read the minds of the folks at the FDA with this. And, you know, in their defense, they're on a learning curve, too, with all of this. And I don't think they're trying to do disjustice to industry, but at the same time, they want to protect patients. All it's going to take is one EPO disaster in the biosimilar space to take us back 5 years in this whole field. It could just totally stall the development and integration of biosimilars. So if anything, I think they may be erring on the safety side. But in the long run, I think that's, you know, you have these used by oncologists or other physicians for other indications. I think that extra time and effort and diligence is very appropriate at this point in time. With time, we may get more relaxed. They may get more relaxed. But right now, if I was in industry or giving industry advice, I'd say more is better at this point. I know it's cost, and ultimately we're hoping that we'll reduce costs. But the more convincing evidence you can provide to the FDA, the more likely you'll get it approved first go around, and also put that data out in the public space by whatever means necessary so that docs can see it and be comfortable using it.
What about red cell growth factors?
Of course, they have, and again, I was not involved with the trials, but we now have a biosimilar Epogen Alpha. I don't think it's hit the marketplace yet, but I could be wrong in some regions, but the FDA has approved it. You know, I think there was a fair amount of anxiety because of the prior history in this space. And my projection is, but I don't have a crystal ball, is, of course, EPO use in general in oncology fell dramatically due to a number of factors, but has never regained the heyday of use of Epoetin or Darbepoetin in oncology. So there's already that more limited use in oncology. And now you have a new Epoetin Alpha biosimilar out there. I think it's going to be a slow slog for the uptake of this in oncology practice. That's my projection. And not because of any safety concerns. I think they fulfilled the requirements of the FDA to get approval. But I think uptake in oncology is going to be very slow.
So what about the other two major biosimilars in oncology, one to trastuzumab and the other to bevacizumab? Can you talk about the data that supported those agents and where we are today with them?
Well, they're both approved. The bevacizumab was put forward and approved under the company, I think, making the case that, you know, they know how to make biologics and they've done it for a long time. And who better to make biosimilars than a manufacturer of reference biologic? And they got approval as a biosimilar in colorectal, I think in ovarian. The trastuzumab biosimilar was studied in a comparative trial, I think the Heritage trial. And again, it was a equivalence trial compared to both U.S. and EU versions of trastuzumab. And again, looking at, this was in metastatic breast cancer with HER2-positive metastatic disease, and objective response was the primary outcome. So a two-arm study comparing the originator and the biosimilar.
Of course, that's with chemotherapy, though.
With a taxane,
with a taxane,
yes.
Right.
Yes. And again, it fell within the equivalence margins. No immunogenicity issues surfaced, and it seemed to fulfill all the criteria. I don't believe it has also entered the marketplace yet, but I, again, could be wrong in some areas. But I think both of these are projected to be out early 2019 in actual practice.
What kinds of discussions have you heard about the potential use of both of these agents? When you think about trastuzumab and all the different ways it might be used. Now it's used combined with pertuzumab, which I doubt that's been looked at. It's used in the curative adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting. It's used in the palliative end stage. It's used by itself occasionally. It's used with capecitabine, other agents. How do you see clinicians sort of sorting through how they might use the drug?
Yeah, well, obviously, again, we don't know for sure, but what I have heard and some of my own feelings about it are, I think, the graduated introduction into oncology will probably start where the trial data was in metastatic patients. I think if you're not treating for curative intent, your anxiety level may not be quite as high. Obviously, you don't want to harm the patients. You want them to get the best benefit out of these. But I think that's where it will probably begin to be integrated. I think there's a fair reluctance to use this up front yet, primarily about efficacy, but, you know, obviously both safety and efficacy. You may recall at the ASCO meeting, there was a study reported on biosimilar rituximab data. And what they showed was that there were certain factors that influenced whether a clinician, oncologist, would use a biosimilar rituximab, very similar type of scenario. And what they saw was that they were far more likely to use it in second and third line therapy, and specifically in follicular lymphoma as opposed to B-cell lymphoma. So I think clinicians, being the skeptics and conservative folks that we often are, although it's interesting that we're often the first ones to jump on a new treatment that comes out. But in this case, I think we're going to probably gradually introduce these agents into our practice, starting with the less, you know, presumably less risky situation of metastatic disease or a setting where you're treating to improve survival, but not necessarily eradicate the disease. And only with time, as you see those patients are doing just as well and their tolerance is just as good, might you begin to introduce it into early stage or more curable disease settings. But frankly, again, we have very little data on what U.S. oncologists are going to do in this space. I think the European experience has been pretty much along the lines of what I just mentioned, that far more ready use of these agents in the advanced disease or incurable setting before bringing them into early stage disease.
What about bevacizumab? To what extent is it being used right now? And there, almost always it's used in combination with chemotherapy, which, you know, when you look at data, it makes it a little harder to figure out what's going on because it's kind of diluting the benefit. But any thoughts about bevacizumab?
Yeah. Well, I have a checkered history with bevacizumab, as you may or may not know, because I was on ODAC both when it got approved for accelerated approval in breast cancer and then got removed or recommended against and removed from the label. And I think its use in breast cancer is at most sporadic at this point. But the bevacizumab originator certainly is used in colorectal cancer and ovarian cancer and in other disease settings. And I have no data. In fact, I don't think the biosimilar bevacizumab is yet being utilized or available in the marketplace. But my sense is that it's probably going to take the same type of path I just mentioned, being used maybe in metastatic colorectal cancer in combination with chemotherapy and in other advanced disease settings. But as you pointed out, it's very difficult in these combination regimens to necessarily sort out both toxicities and efficacy. We saw the same issue with bevacizumab, some work that we did while I was at Duke, where there was concern that bevacizumab increased the risk of venous thromboembolism in patients. And because it's an angiogenic agent, that seemed to make sense. And we had some pretty good data that there was a small increase in arterial thrombotic events. When we did the analysis, we did an individual patient data meta-analysis, we saw that because patients getting bevacizumab compared to chemotherapy alone were having longer durations of response, they were at risk for these events for about twice as long as the comparative chemotherapy alone arm. And if you adjusted for that, the significant effect on venous thromboembolism disappeared. So because of the dual use of these in combination with chemotherapy, almost all current indications, I think we're going to need a great deal of this post-marketing surveillance for all these agents. But I would say I'd put bevacizumab at the top of the stack in terms of making sure that clinicians are reporting very carefully adverse events. We hate to do it. We don't do it very well in some cases. But for these biosimilar agents, such as bevacizumab, trastuzumab, and even the growth factors, we really need to track these agents. The FDA is working with both industry and ASCO and their CancerLink effort to try to track safety and efficacy adverse events across the board. And they are particularly focused on, as these biosimilars come into clinical practice, to have as much tracking of their effects and adverse events as possible. And I can only encourage that. I think the more and more diligence we give after these are approved, the rare delayed side effects hopefully will capture and be able to get on top of reasonably quickly, even though it will be in the marketplace.
So, Gary, this has really been fascinating to chat with you today. Anything you want to add? Anything we didn't cover that you want to just bring up?
You know, again, there's so many unknowns, as you led off. We don't know how much impact this is going to have on cost yet. The reason we're doing it, or one of the reasons we're doing it, is hopefully to drive down prices, bring in competition, improve access to these. I think these are all good motivations, but time will tell. And part of that uncertainty, a big part of it, is clinicians want to do the best for their patients. They want to protect the patients. And yeah, they want to be diligent about cost and do the best for the public domain, but their primary responsibility is to the patient that's sitting in front of them and the treatments they're recommending. So I think there's going to be a slower uptake of these agents in the U.S. than has been experienced in Europe, which is more regulated, homogeneous, I mean, in different countries, but across the board, much more regulated healthcare environment than in the U.S. I think the uptake will be slower in the U.S. I'm optimistic that the processes that the FDA has put in place and continues to improve on as they learn, along with the rest of us, will demonstrate that they've done the right thing in terms of regulatory oversight, review, and approval. But we have to keep our vigilance very high, and that's at all levels, the government, the clinicians, even patients. Patients need to know what they're getting. We need to, you know, let them know why we're doing this. And if we have any concerns, let them know. But we all need to keep our eyes open. But I'm optimistic in the end that we're on the right path with this. It's only one part to the puzzle. And we continue to work very aggressively to find other ways of reining in healthcare costs, which has obviously just gotten out of control. Whether this will be a part of that or a key to that, well, time will tell.